It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike throws a coast-to-coast quiz party at which you are all invited to be guests. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please continues on its carefree go-as-you-please way. Tonight's quizzes are John Kieran, sports expert and general authority on most everything, Franklin P. Adams, conductor of the New York Post's Conning Tower, our old friend, the composer and music critic, Deems Taylor, and as our fourth guest, a new friend, the distinguished president of Vassar College, Dr. Henry Noble McCracken. By the way, Dr. McCracken, the last time we had the pleasure of entertaining anyone from Vassar on this program was when we had the dean of your college here, Dean...
Thompson.
Yes, Dean Thompson. My recollection is that she's the only guest we ever had who made a 100% score.
We're very proud of that.
Yes, and it would be tough if the president didn't do as well. those who are listening, that for each question that's missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Suppose we start the festivities this evening with a question from C.S. Marsh of Washington, D.C. Now, this is about college presidents or deans. Name four college presidents or deans who made good in the non-academic world. Name four. I'll leave it to you to determine what making good means. Dr. McCracken? Mr. Adams?
Thomas Woodrow Wilson.
Thomas Woodrow Wilson. That would be the most distinguished example, perhaps. Yes. Of what college was he president?
Princeton University.
Princeton University. 100%, Mr. Adams. Now let's get three more. Mr. Kieran?
John Houston Finley became editor of the New York Times, if you count that. He was president of College of the City of New York and also of a smaller college out in the Midwest.
And then became editor of the New York Times. Yes, I should think that would be an elevation. Dr. McCracken.
Congressman Fess from Ohio. Later, I think, Senator Fess, Simeon Fess.
Had he been president of college?
He was president of a college in Ohio.
What college was that, Dr. McCracken?
I think it was Wittenberg. I won't be sure.
And you would consider that becoming a congressman would be an elevation from a college president? All right,
I'm glad.
Yes, Mr. Taylor, it's a change. That gives us three. One more. Dr. McCracken.
George Vincent, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and director of public health.
Formerly?
Formerly president of the University of Minnesota.
Good enough. By the way, isn't it true, Dr. McCracken, that you are not the only member of your family who is or was a college president? You have a brother who was a college president, and you had a father who was a college president?
His father gave me my diploma.
Really?
Yeah.
One of his mistakes.
I bet the son would never have done it. Family disability, Dr. McCracken, college presidency?
Tradition of the Yankee peddler and the Scotch schoolmaster.
I see. Well, a very good tradition it is. Now, the second question comes from Herman W. Farwell, Jr. of New York City. Get two out of three on this one. This is about birds, Mr. Kieran. In what work of literature or in what movie do we find the following? The first is A Parliament of Birds. A Parliament of Birds. Dr. McCracken.
Chaucer's poem.
What poem is it?
The Parliament of Foolers, or the Parliament of Birds.
Yes, you say the Parliament of Foolers. In ordinary English, that would be what?
Birds.
Or fowls, we might say.
Yes.
Yes. Where would you find a group of birds who assisted a housekeeper? Mr. Kieran.
That was in the movie by Disney, Snow White.
Yes, very good. Snow White assisted in cleaning her home by the birds. Now, where would you find a commonwealth of birds? A commonwealth of birds. Dr. McCracken.
In Aristophanes' comedy.
Yes, called the birds. Very good. And that gives us three birds out of three. Very good. Now, how about the next one from Mrs. Mary C. Sobey of Canton, Connecticut? Get all on this. We've all read the Declaration of Independence. Before any form of government is mentioned in the Declaration,
several self-evident truths are listed. Name them. Dr. McCracken, you start us off?
That all men are created equal.
That is one.
That they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights.
Yes.
And that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's right. And that's something to memorize and remember. That's quite right. Thank you, Dr. McCracken. Now, the next question comes from Robert S. Lanning of Providence, Rhode Island. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. Dr. McCracken, I was told just before I stepped up here this evening that last week you gave your Shakespeare class in Vassar a very hard Shakespeare test. Is that right?
I had hoped that wouldn't be
mentioned. I understand it's true. And as the hand of fate has sent to us a question from Robert S. Lanning of Providence, Rhode Island, about Shakespeare. Identify the Shakespearean character and tell what each had in his hand when he said the following words. Get 2 out of 3. Here's the first. Quote, "A combination and a form indeed, where every god did seem to set his seal, to give the world assurance of a man." Who says it? And what did he have in his hand when he said those words?
Copy of Shakespeare.
Can you tell me, Mr. Adams?
My guess would be it was somebody in Julius Caesar.
Well, you couldn't be far further afield. No, it wasn't.
I pass.
Mr. Kieran.
That in Hamlet?
Yes.
A skull?
No, not a skull. It's Hamlet who says the words, but he's referring to a picture in a locket. And the picture is, Mr. Kieran, a picture of... Of whom?
His father.
Of his father. And he's referring in praising his father. That gives us one wrong, Dr. McCracken. The second one. This is even harder. "Come, bitter conduct, come, unsavory guide, thou desperate pilot, now at once run on the dashing rocks, thy seasick, weary bark. Here's to my love." Dr. McCracken.
Romeo's. Death speech.
Very good. And what's he holding in his hand when he says the words?
His cup of poison.
That's quite right, Dr. McCracken. That gives you 50% so far. Passing mark is generally 70. Here is the third. Quote, "I that am cruel am yet merciful. I would not have thee linger in thy pain. So. Mr. Kieran.
Othello.
Yes, Othello. And what does he hold in his hand?
Othello.
Yeah, what's he doing?
He's about to smother his wife.
Yes, that's right. He's about to smother Desdemona. I'm sure you remembered that, Dr. McCracken, but Mr. Kieran took it out of your mouth. I know. He does that occasionally. That gives us 2 out of 3 and passes us safely on to the next question, which is a musical question, coming from Mary E. Hutchins of Newport Beach, California. You get 2 out of 3. Now, you're going to hear, played on the piano, 3 different songs. With what well-known singer of past or present do you associate these encores? They were played as encores. They'll be familiar to you. What singer used to sing them? Let's have the first. Well, I think you all know the song. The song, gentlemen, is what?
No Place Like
Home. Home Sweet Home.
Home Sweet Home. And with what singer do you associate that as an encore?
Was it Jenny Lind?
It was indeed, Dr. McCracken. Very good. Jenny Lind. That's one right. Now let's have the next one. Mr. Adams?
Alma Gluck.
Alma Gluck. What's the song?
Carry Me Back to Old Virginia.
Very good.
ASCAP.
I doubt it, as a matter of fact. And the third and last. The song is what, gentlemen? Mr. Taylor?
Well, the song is Schubert's Ave Maria.
You bet. And who would sing it as an encore?
Walt Disney, I should say, in Fantasia.
Yes, it's the last part of Fantasia.
John McCormick.
John McCormick, Mr. Adams, that's very good. And a modern singer occasionally does use Ave Maria as an encore. A great modern singer, would you guess it?
Marian Anderson.
Marian Anderson, Mr. Adams, that's fine.
Yeah. I go around.
That really gives you 4 out of 3, practically, Mr. Adams. Now, the next one, from H. Seaton of this city. Oh, just play around with this, gentlemen. Name 3 plays which mention parts of the human body in their titles, such as The Heart of Maryland, for example, by David Belasco. Give me 3 more. Mr. Kieran.
Arms and the Man.
Arms and the Man, yes. Arms. Let's get 2 more. Mr. Adams?
Shoulder arms.
Yes, I wonder how you thought of that, Mr. Adams.
That's my favorite.
Well, that gives us two arms. I'd like to get...
How about shoulder?
Oh, yes, hadn't thought of shoulder. That's right. Mr. Dr. McCracken.
The Idol's Eye.
The Idol's Eye. Who wrote it?
I don't know, but Frank Daniels used to act in it.
Well, Victor Herbert wrote
good enough
Victor
for me.
Herbert.
All right, if Frank Daniels
and
acted
Harry
in it, that's
B.
all right with me. How about it, Mr. Taylor?
Back to Methuselah.
Back to Methuselah. How about Chu Chin Cha? Wasn't there a play called Chu Chin Cha?
Yes.
Hedda Gabler. There's lots of them. How about this one from Barbara Cassaday? Well, I think that's all we'll have time for the first part of the program. Now, so far, we've paid out exactly nothing, and we have delivered no sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Nice work, Prex.
Now, Mr. Cross gives us an inside glimpse of how he's building up a reputation as a walking encyclopedia of tobacco facts.
Well, I don't know about being a walking encyclopedia, Mr. Fadiman, but I've found that being associated with a cigarette program causes one to be involved in discussions about tobacco and so on. And I'm really prepared because I can quote the reports from America's big tobacco markets that I read on this program. These reports show that Lucky Strike consistently pays higher prices to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. Let me read you one example. At tobacco auctions in Reidsville, North Carolina during the past season, the American Tobacco Company paid 44% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 44% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. Now, doesn't that one fact carry more weight than 1,000 words? Doesn't it say to you, smoke Lucky's for finer, lighter, milder tobaccos?
Mr. Cross, it says it say very concisely, too, in 62 seconds by my watch. And now we'll go on with the second half of the program this evening, with a question that comes from Barbara Cassaday of Columbus, Ohio. I think we ought to get all on this. What is the difference, gentlemen, between a hobo, a tramp, and a bum? We might throw the whole question to Dr. McCracken if you prefer. Or would you gentlemen want to share this among you? A hobo, a tramp, and a bum. Mr. Taylor? Mr. Kieran?
Well, a bum is just a fellow who... never wants any work and won't take any work and just hits you for a handout.
Hits you for a handout.
Yes.
Yeah.
A tramp.
Successfully, I hope.
A tramp tramps the roads, mostly, and will work for a meal occasionally. A hobo may be what they call a working stiff. He may be a boomer, drift from town to town.
Yes.
And will take employment for a time and then hobo it off along on the freights. Hit a peddler or a hot shot. And,
say, where have you been all your life? Mr. Kieran, that's a perfect answer, as a matter of fact.
Sounds like an autobiography.
Right, Mr. Taylor, it does. And I thought you were only a sports expert. That is exactly right. Mr. Kieran has hit off the exact differences between a hobo, a tramp, and a bum. And I wonder where some of these words come from. Mr. Kieran, would you guess where the word hobo comes from? I don't think anyone knows exactly.
Hoboken.
That is slander, I believe.
No, it's not. That's where it came from and was thrown out of the language because it had no foundation.
Well, who says it came from Hoboken?
I read it in a book.
Well, I read
volume.
In a book. I can read, too, Mr. Adams. That, I read in a book that it comes from Hoboy, H-O-E, space, B-O-Y. That is an agricultural migratory worker, fellow who handles a hoe.
Oh.
Don't like that? What's the matter with that, Mr. Kieran?
That's old French.
That's an oboe.
That's old French for oboe. It's
oboe. Oh, no.
H-A-U-T-B-O-Y.
I can spell, too. I mean ho boy. I don't mean oboe.
A ho boy, yes.
Yeah, all right.
Ho boy, where do we go from here?
Well, we go from there to bum. Where do you think bum comes from?
I think bum may have some connection with the German bummeln, but...
Yes.
I'm not certain. There's an English word, bum, for an unmentionable part of the anatomy.
Yes,
but
that's right.
We'd rather keep to the German.
It's been mentioned now.
Yes, it's too late. I think that is what it comes from. Bummel, meaning to loaf or something like that, an idler. As for tramp, I suppose it just comes from the well-known Dutch or Phoenician tramp. Yes,
Sanskrit.
Yes,
that's Tramp, Tramp, Tramp.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the next question comes to us from Blessing Brown of Ontario, California. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. To what do the following similes from familiar quotations refer? The first is black as the pit. To what does that refer? Mr. Adams.
Invictus.
Well, I meant, what does
black as the pit from pole to pole.
I don't mean what poem it comes from. You're quite right, Mr. Adams. But what does the actual simile refer to? What
out
is black as the pit?
The night.
The night, yes. The night. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit, and so forth. Now, the next, sighing like furnace. Sighing like furnace. Dr. McCracken.
The lover.
The lover. Where do you find the
Shakespeare's
phrase?
Ages of Man and As You Like It.
And As You Like It.
Speech.
Can you give us the rest of the line? Sighing like furnace. Does any of you remember it?
Next the lovers, sighing like a furnace.
Fashioning a sonnet to his mistress' eyebrows.
That's right, yes. With a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. That gives us 2 out of 2. Now, what does this simile refer to? Like a tea tray in the sky. Like a tea tray in the sky. Was that your hand up, Mr. Taylor?
It was about half up. twinkle, twinkle. Now, wait a minute.
Bat.
Little bat, Dr. McCracken.
How
McCracken.
I wonder
right.
What your hat.
Yes?
Like a...
Up above the world, so high.
Like a tea tray in the sky.
Well,
it's Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland. And the tea tray is...
perfect nonsense.
Yeah, sure. It's the bat. That gives us 3 out of 3. What can you do with this one? Here is another musical question from Virginia Hall of German, Pennsylvania. Let's get all on this. There are 3 parts. You're now going to hear little selections played on bell-like instruments. In what musical works, whether symphonic or operatic, would they be heard? Let's have the first. That's very nice. Thank you. Mr. Taylor.
It's the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite.
Oh, that's exactly right. Very good. And what is the instrument that was being played there?
The celeste.
The celeste. Let's have the second. Mr. Taylor again.
The bell song from Lakme by Delib.
Hey, that's pretty good, Mr. Taylor. And what is the instrument that was being played?
Glockenspiel.
And in English?
Bells.
Yes.
But it's always called Glockenspiel, though, when you're on the orchestra score. Yes.
That's
called bell to get confused with gongs.
Oh, gee, we don't have any gongs tonight.
Well, that's all right.
All right,
now
see what you can do with the next one, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Taylor again.
Entrance of the Knights of the Grail from Wagner's Parsifal.
You specialize in bell-like music?
Yes,
you?
I'm the
very good.
Bell
3 out of 3, Mr. Taylor, and thank you very much indeed. And may I ask what the rest of you were doing during the last 30 seconds?
Wondering at Mr. Taylor.
This one from Mrs. Ethel Phillips of New York City. It's a 2-part question, and I think we ought to get both parts. Now, next week, we are going to celebrate the Bill of Rights Week. And a good many of us are going to think about that very precious heritage. Here are 2 situations that Mrs. Ethel Phillips has made up for us in which the Bill of Rights is involved. Here's the first. Suppose an attempt was made in Congress to pass a law requiring a newspaper to submit the dispatches of foreign correspondents to the State Department before publication here. Would the Bill of Rights afford any protection against that proposed bill? Mr. Adams.
I think it would.
And what makes you say that?
I think the First Amendment about the liberty of the press.
That's right. We may not, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion and so forth, or abridging the freedom of speech of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Therefore, that law could never be even instituted in Congress, would you say, Dr. McCracken?
Yes, never be passed.
It never would be passed, probably would never be even thought of. Now, here is another situation. Suppose the United States Army sent a regiment to Vassar College, Dr. McCracken, and ordered the president of the college to billet the regiment on the campus for the night. Now, this would be very nice for the regiment, possibly. But what would the Bill of Rights have to say about that situation?
The Third Amendment to the Constitution.
What would that say?
That would say that there shall be no billeting of soldiers in private homes.
That's right. No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war except in a manner to be prescribed by law. That gives us 2 out of 2. Now, how about this one from Mrs. H.D. Smith of Green Island, New York? I think we ought to get all on this. It doesn't seem to me to be very hard. Here's a question about some nice little girls of fiction. Nice little girls of fiction. You're an expert on nice little girls, Dr. McCracken. You spend a large part of your time with them.
The bad ones, too.
I'm so glad that you have a proper balance up in Vassar. Now, this first little girl was a little girl who went to extremes. Mr. Adams.
When she was good, she was very, very good, and bad. When she was bad, she was horrid.
Very good, yes, that's right. That's the little girl with the curl. Now, the second little girl was happy because she broke her leg. Was happy because she broke her leg. Now, there's a nice little girl for you.
Happy because
happy
she broke
because,
her
you
leg.
Don't believe it, Mr. Taylor, do you?
No.
Well, I think we ought to remember this, because some of you may have read the book in your childhood, and many of you have seen the picture. It was Pollyanna. You know, Pollyanna was happy about everything.
I never.
You don't remember that, Mr. Taylor?
No, I don't. I would dream of reading.
Oh, I think that's sheer prejudice. She was happy about everything, but particularly about breaking her leg, because when she broke her leg, her Aunt Polly called her dear lots of times, which she never used to do before she broke her leg. Is that perfectly clear?
If she'd called her, broken her neck, she'd have called her darling.
And then she would have been really happy. That gives us one wrong. Now, how about a little girl? A little girl who was as good as gold. Mr. Adams.
Gentle Jane.
Where do you find Gentle Jane?
In Patience, I think.
Yes, Patience. By whom?
W.S. Gilbert.
Very good. And can you give us the quotation which proves that Gentle Jane was
Gentle
as good
Jane
as...
was good as gold. She always did as she was told.
Very, very pretty. Thank you. That gives us only 2 out of 3, which is not quite enough. That sends $25 and a set of the Britannica, courtesy of Lucky Strike, to Mrs. Smith. Thank you.
And 1 volume of Pollyanna.
I can see that book will never be popular among the guests on this program. Here's a question coming to us from Washington, D.C., from Mrs. L. Starobin. It's about senators. Get all on this. Identify the following senators of fact and fiction. The first is Senator Loganberry, which is a graft. Senator Loganberry. Mr. Taylor?
Well, I'll take him. He's in Louisiana Purchase.
Yes. It's
the music by Irving Berlin.
Very good.
Whose daughter is here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a perfect plug. Now, Mr. Kieran, what were you going to say that?
I was going to say it's Victor Moore under another name.
Well, all right.
Victor Moore plays the part of Loganberry in Louisiana
Purchase. Booked by Maury Riskind, who was on this program once.
That's enough of this, gentlemen. Let's get on to the next part of the question. Senator Krakauskas, or Krakauskas. He's a senator, Mr. Kieran.
Yeah, he's a senator. He's a pitcher for the Washington Senators.
That's right. And finally, gentlemen, Brabantio. Brabantio, Mr. Kieran?
He was a senator who, I believe, was either the father or the uncle. I believe he was the father of Mrs. Othello.
Yes, Mrs. Othello. Her maiden name being? Cracken had us, he knew that answer, too. Very hard to stick you boys tonight. How about this one? This comes from Florence Whitcher of Wichita, Kansas. It's a single-part question. What territory was named by a Scotsman, colonized by Frenchmen, ruled by an English king, and immortalized by an American poet? What territory? Quite a career, as you can see.
That's a lot of work.
Say that over again.
Say it over again, all right. What territory was named by a Scotsman, colonized by Frenchmen, ruled by an English king, and immortalized by an American poet? Mr. Adams.
Nova Scotia.
Absolutely right, Mr. Adams. And can you prove your point? Don't have to.
Immortalized by Longfellow and Evangeline.
You bet. And it was colonized by...
Acadian.
Yes, Dr. McCracken, can you go on with the story?
Well, the Acadian, the Acadie, the French province. Was...
That's right. And what
settlers
was the...
were named for them.
That's quite right.
Mostly Breton.
Who was the English king that ruled over Nova Scotia?
One of those Jameses.
Sure, that's correct, Mr. Taylor. George that's correct. Third. Which James was it?
Oh, I don't. I have no favorites.
Oh, just pick a James.
James the second.
What did you say,
James
Mr. Adams?
James the second.
You're exaggerating, Mr. Adams.
James
the first. Yes, and the territory was named by Sir William Alexander, who obtained a grant from James the first in 1621. Sir William Alexander was a Scotsman.
And the name means New Scotland.
And the name, as you say, means New Scotland. That's very clever of you, Mr. Taylor. I hadn't expected you to see it.
I don't like to bring it up.
Here's one from Carl A. Kopetsky of Chicago. Name three people in public life whose entire names are composed of three first names. For example, there's a well-known prize fighter named John Henry Lewis. Isn't there, Mr. Kieran?
Yes.
Now, can you give me three other people in public life whose names are similarly all first names? Three names in each case. I should expect you to get one of them, Mr. Taylor.
Oh, me?
Yeah. You're a musician of sorts, aren't you, Mr. Taylor?
Yes.
Listen to the stuff from time to time.
Yeah.
Dr. McCracken?
Augustus John?
It's two.
That's only two names. That's very good. Oh, but if he had a middle name, such as Timothy, that would be fine. But I don't think he has.
Well, you could call him Henry Augustus John.
You could, but it would be a bluff. Oh. How about John Charles Thomas, Mr. Taylor?
I'm afraid you're right.
You bet I'm right. Let's have two more. John Llewellyn Lewis, the former head of the CIO. Mr. Kieran, how about a well-known baseball player? George Herman Root, that would be a good one. At a venture, I will say Jeanette MacDonald, and no one will say me nay. I think you've done very badly on that, gentlemen. In that sense, $25.
You were wonderful.
A set of the Britannica to Mr. Kopetsky, courtesy of Lucky Strike.
And we're like now, the mayor. When we make a mistake, it's a beaut.
You bet it's a beaut. And now Mr. Cross has something to say about southern travelers, and he doesn't mean winter vacationists.
No, the travelers I refer to are the independent tobacco experts who follow the tobacco trail from one market to another during the auction seasons. As the crops come to auction, many of these men travel from Florida and Georgia up to the Carolinas, Maryland, and Virginia, then out to Kentucky and Tennessee. Now, the interesting thing for you smokers to know is that at thousands of auctions, these independent buyers, auctioneers, and warehouse men see who pays the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. And what cigarette do the veterans of the tobacco trail choose for their own smoking enjoyment? It's Lucky's by an overwhelming majority. Yes, sworn records show that over twice as many independent tobacco experts smoke Lucky's exclusively as smoke all other cigarettes combined. Remember that fact next time you buy cigarettes. With men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. For the enjoyment of finer, lighter, milder tobaccos, ask for Lucky Strike.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Tonight, Lucky Strike has sent out a total of $50 and two sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Dr. McCracken, and thank you, Mr. Taylor, for attending Lucky Strike's party this evening. Now, next week, we'll have the two regulars, John Kieran and Franklin P. Adams, with us as usual. And we welcome back from Hollywood, with a flourish, the inimitable Oscar Levant, who has added acting to his career as musician and composer. Our special guest will be the world-famous sculptor and raconteur, Joe Davidson. Now, remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Lucky's pay higher prices for the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With the independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.